This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
A lot of new teachers are becoming ex-teachers in a year or two, and that makes it increasingly difficult for the teachers who stay to live a well-rounded life while also being effective in the classroom. Basically, they have to learn to get a life.
I realized I was going to have to make some changes if I wasn't going to have a total, complete breakdown, shutdown, like whatever.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a high school teacher who has written about how teachers can reclaim their lives. We'll also hear from a teacher who has a less optimistic view of the profession, and we'll spend an academic minute finding out how teachers can avoid becoming academic roadkill, because that's fun. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. A lot of people who get into the teaching profession get out of it in just a few years. This not only means more teachers need to be recruited and trained, but more pressure is put on the teachers who are left behind. That causes them to burn out, and it's a great big ugly circle. Now, we're not here today to solve all those systematic problems, but we might be able to help take a little pressure off those long-time teachers who stick around. Dave Stewart Jr. is a high school teacher in Cedar Springs, Michigan, and has been blogging about teaching for the past few years. One of his latest topics is how to be a teacher and still have a life. I spoke to Dave about this and asked what it is about teaching that can preclude having a real live life.
I think that the main thing about teaching that makes it so difficult to have a life is that teachers are driven by, you know, not the latest accountability regime, not the standardized tests. We're driven by a deep-seated desire to make a difference in the lives of students. And that just comes with what feels like the weight of the world on your shoulders when you see how the tiniest little interaction or a lesson can make such a huge difference in a student's life when they report that back to you years later. Things like that, well, it deeply makes you see and believe that everything that we do has this weight to it. And so I think naturally what happens is teachers start to try to do it all, try to hold all that weight and try to make sure that absolutely every last thing gets done. And all of a sudden, they really cease to have what you could call a life. I guess that's how I would put it.
And how did you come to this topic? When did you say, okay, I've got to work on, you know, helping teachers get a life, including yourself, I assume?
Well, I was about 4 years into my career pursuing my master's degree at the American College of Education, which was all online. So I was doing that at nighttime. I was a full-time teacher during the day. I was also a father and a husband, which are pretty important to me. And I basically, you know, the candle was burning every which way, and there was not much left. And so I realized I was going to have to make some changes if I wasn't going to have a total, complete breakdown, shutdown, like whatever. So that's what made me really start to approach this from a fresh angle and ask some really hard questions of myself and how I was using my time.
Well, what were some of those questions?
Well, first of all, what's the order of priority of these different tasks in my life? I realized that, you know, while I do hold the responsibility I have to my students, to my students' parents, I hold that as something that's sacred as a public school teacher. One thing that I didn't do with my students is walk down an aisle in front of a bunch of witnesses and make a vow, you know, that I would be there for them my whole life in thick or thin. And I did make such a vow to my wife. My children, the children that live in my home, the ones who have my last name attached to them, those kids just have one dad. My students have many teachers, right? So I had to start to really say, well, I want to be the absolute best teacher that I can be, but that has to exist within boundaries. That cannot just get a blank check on my life any longer.
So what are the ways that some teachers can prioritize things correctly, do you think?
Yeah, I think, Bob, that the first thing teachers can do is just decide when is quitting time. When am I going to be done working? And they can do this with an easy conscience. A lot of us, we hold to this dogma that, you know, the best teachers, they can never turn it off. They never, you know, they can't leave work at work, and like they kind of exalt this as something that is praiseworthy. And I think that it's not a necessary dogma. I think that we can say I am all in 100% until 5 p.m. or whatever time. You know, for me, it's 5 p.m. I work every day till 5 p.m. But when 5 p.m. hits, I'm switching gears, I'm heading home, and then my job is to be there fully present for my family. And what this does, this placement of constraints on the time that we will work, is it forces me to figure out what actions in my workday are most important for the success of my classroom, for the success of my students, for the success of me as a teacher. What actions are most important, and what actions, you know, actually do I not need to give the time that I was previously giving them?
Even when you do that, is there scrutiny, more scrutiny on teachers living their day-to-day life? I think of, you know, people on social media making sure that, you know, every picture that they post of themselves is appropriate.
Sure, yeah. I think that, you know, the reality is teachers are public figures. And a lot of us, we don't get into teaching thinking I want to be a public figure. But that is just a reality of the work, I think. And I always talk to my students and to teachers about this idea of how do we make our lives easier by just being basically the same person all the time, right? I mean, there are ways that I used to act in college that, you know, frankly, were not ways that I would ever want anyone to know about, right? Just I was a stereotypical college goof-off. And obviously these are things that I would never want to post on social media or anything like that. But as I move further into my career as a teacher and into my life as a father and husband, I realize that, you know, the goal is really to live a life where it would be fine if someone were following me with a news camera at all times. And, of course, that sets the bar really high, but I think that it sets the bar appropriately high, just so that I'm a one person, one whole person, not this fragmented person who has to totally change who he is while he's got the shirt and tie on at work, and then totally change who he is when he's with his friends and with his spouse and so on.
Is this a tougher thing to do in a less affluent school district? Do you think that the teachers who don't have, you know, the means or the funding behind the school have a lot more to do?
I think that there's no doubt about it. If you look at the types of schools that teachers stick in for a long time versus the types of schools that have horrific teacher attrition rates, there's no doubt about the fact that the task of the teacher in the under-resourced school is more intense, is more difficult, is more fraught with pressure and stress than the task of the teacher in the in the more affluent setting, the setting where there are just more resources to go around. In my own career, I've taught in Baltimore, Maryland, and now in a small town in Michigan. And while the small town of Michigan is by no means affluent, it is relatively affluent to the community in which my school was situated in Baltimore. And I can just tell you that there is a different level of pressure on me in small town Michigan than there was in the middle school I taught at in Baltimore. So I do think that teachers in under-resourced situations have a much greater challenge than teachers in other situations.
What kind of feedback do you get on your blog when you're talking about this topic?
You know, I think that this is the main thing people stick around for at my blog. Teachers tell me, they'll email or comment saying, that's exactly what I needed to hear. You gave me permission, you know, to not try to do it all. You gave me a breath of fresh air. You helped me rediscover why I got into this job in the first place. I think it's sort of unfortunate that my blog has become somewhat popular, because that means that too many great people, too many educators who have all the right stuff, you know, all the right material is there for them to have careers, long careers that contribute to student flourishing. Too many of these people are getting burnt out, basically chewed up by the current system and you know, kind of spit out. And the result is we've got a system in the United States where more teachers are leaving than are entering. And that's not a sustainable equation.
Well, looking ahead, are things getting better, getting worse, and what needs to happen to make it better?
Well, things have to get better at the individual level, the school and district level, and I think at the broader policy level. The good news is that I think that we still do have a lot more autonomy than we think. We have autonomy over how we approach the task. We have autonomy over whether or not we're going to choose to try to love our students and teach them from a place of love and care. We have a lot of internal autonomy, I think, even in the worst systems in the country. I believe that. At the school and building level, I think the schools and buildings still do have the ability, great administrators especially, still do have the ability to siphon through what is mandatory but not ultimately important for long-term student flourishing, and therefore needs to be satisfied to be completed as quickly as possible, but without tons of resource. What are those? What's in that bucket? And then what's in the bucket of the actual work, with a capital W, the work that schools are about, the long-term flourishing of kids? Now we enter into the policy level, and this is where, Bob, I'm just not an expert at this point, but I don't think the solution lies in more high-stakes accountability measures. I don't think the solution lies in creating systems that are going to place added pressure on teachers. I just don't see how that's going to solve the current problem that we're facing.
You've written, and I think you used the word very well, that your goal as a teacher is to promote the long-term flourishing of kids. Talk about that word, promote.
Well, I think that's key, because we picture who we want to be when we enter the teaching, and picture this person who guarantees that all the kids will succeed, right? I'm not going to let you not succeed. And essentially, I think this places us in a higher position than we actually are capable of possessing. We are not omnipotent. We cannot guarantee the success of all of our students. But at the same time, we have to do everything in our power to be constantly getting better at promoting the success of our kids, creating classroom environments, creating lessons, units, everything about our practice. We want to be contributing to the likelihood that kids will go out and lead choice-filled, flourishing lives, right? But at the end of the day, we can quit at quitting time, because we know that our task is not to guarantee it. It's just to do all in our power to promote it. And I think that's an important shift that a lot of teachers need to make.
Dave Stewart Jr. is a high school teacher in Cedar Springs, Michigan. You can read his blog at davestewartjr.com. Still to come, there are some teachers who are a little less optimistic about the profession. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and there are very good reasons that I produce a program about education instead of going out and, you know, educating. One of them has to do with my lack of qualifications. The other is explained by a new book by Jane Morris called Teacher Misery: Helicopter Parents, Special Snowflakes, and Other BS. Now, two things you should know. One, Jane Morris is not her real name. She enjoys getting a paycheck. And two, BS is not abbreviated in the real title of the book. The book details her experiences with students at a big city school that are at the same time maddening, infuriating, and hilarious. I spoke with Ms. Morris over the summer about the book and asked if she's still teaching.
I do love it, and there's something that is almost a bit addicting about the challenges that you go through. Like, I can't imagine having a regular day job just sitting at a desk. I do think that I would get bored. And the sense of fulfillment that you get when you do see a kid change, get them to care more about their education, or just to be a nicer, more respectful person in general, is very personally fulfilling. Plus, it's hilarious, as you could see in the book. I mean, I'm just laughing all the time, because if I didn't, I'd probably cry. But if you have a good sense of humor, I think so much of what goes on is very funny.
Of the stories and the students that we hear about, please tell me they're a minority, that the majority of students are just kids trying to go about their day.
They're not the majority. The majority of kids are just, they don't really stand out, but they don't really cause trouble. They're just right, just trying to get through the day. But the troublemakers, the difficult kids, there's a lot of them. Depending on what school you work in, I think if they come from a more troubled background, more poverty, there's a lot. And the less administration supports teachers, the more kids see that they can get away with that behavior, and the more kids kind of join in. But there are so many really wonderful kids, which I probably should have touched on more in the book, but it is called Teacher Misery, so, you know, it's about the bad parts.
They're not contributing to your misery.
No, I mean, they are the ones that are just amazing human beings and give me hope for humanity. I mean, there are a lot of kids that do so much volunteer work. They travel around the world trying to help people just because they want to, and are just really good, caring people. So being there for those kids, you know, definitely keeps me going. And I always tell myself, focus on those kids and try to brush off the nasty ones.
Given the obvious subject matter of the book, your name, as we know it, is not your real name, and you have not identified the school or the school district. I am going to assume, though, this is a larger city, though, right?
It is. It's a large city.
Is this just in the school you were in, or have you taken stories from other teachers in other localities?
Well, I thought what I was experiencing was so outrageous, it had to be just me. But then when I started my Instagram, Teacher Misery, it was teachers following me, thousands and thousands of teachers, and they were all saying, thank you for voicing this. This is what I experienced. Then I started just asking questions on Instagram. Tell me your worst thing that's happened with a parent. Tell me your worst interaction with an administrator. And then the stories that people were telling were just as crazy or crazier than mine. So I started to realize that overall, this is how education is going in this country, that the parents have all the power and they tend to believe their kids more than they believe teachers. And there's just less and less respect for teachers. So the job just keeps getting harder and harder.
My next question was right there. What's the biggest problem, the students or the parents?
So they call it entitlement. There's this term in education, special snowflake, is the kid that has been treated not just special because every kid is special, but that they're better than everyone else and they're entitled to certain treatment. The kids come in with that attitude, expecting things without working for it. They come in with this attitude of you need to earn their respect. Then there's administration that often really, there are no consequences for anything. So it's sort of a twofold issue where the parents blaming the teacher and then administration is not following through with any consequences, which undermines the teacher.
That is something that comes up again over and over in the book. I wrote this student up. Nothing happened. What, if anything, can happen?
Well, different schools handle things differently. But that is, again, something that I've talked about with a lot of teachers, where they write a kid up for something outrageous and they have a little chat, if anything. They have a chat with the administrator and it's a friendly chat. And then they come back and what the message that they got was, I can do things like this and nothing will happen. The thing is that schools are so overrun with very big issues that the smaller issues, they have to kind of fall by the wayside, like kids coming late to class. They just don't have the resources to be documenting this and then giving detention and things like that. So there is no consequence for being late. So unless the student is intrinsically motivated or afraid of a phone call home, there really is no reason for them to come to class on time because nothing's going to happen. So we don't even have detention in my school because there's no resources to pay teachers to stay to run detention. The only options that we are given is give your own detention. keep the kid after school, make them stay with you however long you want, which to me, that's detention for me.
Yeah, who's being punished right there?
Right.
Can you talk about some things that while you were going through them just made you mad, and now you look back at them and say, well, that was pretty funny. Or does that not happen? You're still mad about them all.
That's a hard one. You know, the thing is, like, even when I go back and look through the book, I start to get angry. I can't reread some of it because all those old feelings start coming up, and I start to feel angry. But I think some things in retrospect maybe wouldn't hurt as much because I've seen so much and I've been doing it for so long. Like the thing I wrote about where it was my first year and really my first couple of weeks as a teacher, and I got an anonymous email, an online conversation posted between two students talking about how they hate me. So a lot of mean things about me. And it's just the cruelty of why would a kid make up a fake email and send this to me just to hurt me? You know, so at the time I was just crying and kind of rethinking, like, can I handle this job? Because, of course, I didn't think it was going to be quite like that. And I made a very big deal out of it, trying to find out who the email came from. I think now I would immediately get rid of it so that I couldn't read it again and try to brush it off as much as I could.
Jane Morris, not her real name, is the author of Teacher Misery, Helicopter Parents, Special Snowflakes, and Other, you know, BS. You can find her on the Teacher Misery page on Instagram and at Teacher Misery on Twitter. All right, and for one more take on the teaching profession, here's a quick guide to avoid becoming academic roadkill, because avoiding that is a really good thing. It's also the topic of today's Academic Minute.
No one wants to become roadkill. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Martin Krieger, professor of planning at the University of Southern California, discusses how to stay out of the path of danger in the academic world.
I have watched many a faculty member walk in front of an oncoming truck, ask, "What truck?" and become academic roadkill. You don't want to follow their lead. So, it's the work that counts. What is your project? What is the big idea? Tell a story about what you are doing. Buried in the manuscript is the main point. Will a reader notice it? In the introduction, have you presented the main idea and explained it? Organize, draft, rewrite, and then submit. First to a colleague, then to a publication venue, and perhaps then to another venue. Quality matters. Scrupulous matters. Getting it out matters. Audience matter. Teaching and seminars are the occasion to give away the main idea or to find out the speaker's main idea. Find out what is really going on in the speaker's talk. You have to be an active listener. Now, you have a job in a bureaucracy. Do what you're supposed to do, and if not, find a more suitable position. Stay out of nonsense. Realize that you are at a particular stage in your career. You will need the kindness of strangers, even if you have a home run dossier at promotion and tenure time. And you'll need a go bag, so that if the bureaucracy is unresponsive to you, you can find another landing pad. Grants and external support allow you to do your work, and they keep the dean away. Do you owe them, or do they owe you? And just because you are in a fine position does not mean you are worthy. And likely another truck is coming at you. It is already too late if you're asking, what truck?
That was Martin Krieger of the University of Southern California.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.